Welcome to Lady Killers with me, Lucy Worsley, from BBC Radio 4. This is where true crime meets history with a twist. Today, I'm investigating a notorious case from late Victorian London known as the Hampstead Tragedy. It set off a press frenzy, capturing the imaginations of newspaper readers round the world and fueling the Victorian obsession with true crime. And I must warn you that this episode contains graphic and bloody descriptions of violence from the start.
I saw her wheeling a bassinet perambulator in the middle of the road. It was very heavily loaded and covered in some black stuff. She had difficulty pushing it up the hill.
The walls and ceiling and floor were bespattered with blood. I found blood on a poker and a large knife.
I am innocent of this crime. I would not do such a dreadful thing. I would not hurt anyone.
Welcome to Lady Killers. Join me and my all-female team of detectives as we embark on a historical adventure. We're revisiting the unthinkable crimes of murderesses from more than 100 years ago in England, Scotland and the USA. These were ordinary women who did extraordinary things. We hear their words, their voices, and we ask, how did they do it? And more importantly, what drove them to it? It's the morning of the 25th of October, 1890. Two young women are at the Hampstead Mortuary in North London. They've come to identify the body of 31-year-old Phoebe Hogg. Poor Phoebe was found the previous evening, dumped in a nearby street. A compound fracture to the skull suggests that she's been hit hard with a heavy object, her hands and body have been gashed with something sharp, and her throat has been cut from ear to ear. It's a truly gruesome murder. The two young women at the mortuary are Phoebe's sister-in-law, Clara Hogg, and a 24-year-old family friend called Mary Piercy. The sight of Phoebe's mutilated body is too much for Mary.
Clara, that is not Phoebe.
Yes, it is her. It is her, Mary.
Don't touch her, Clara.
Don't drag me away. Leave me alone. You go out.
But it gets worse. Phoebe was last seen leaving the family lodgings the previous afternoon, pushing a pram containing her 17-month-old baby, Tiggy. And Tiggy hasn't been seen since. I want to know, what does this story tell us about the public's passion for forensic science and true crime in 1890s Britain, and our passion for it today? To help me answer these questions, I am thrilled to be joined by today's guest detective. She's one of the UK's leading forensic scientists, Dr. Angela Gallop, CBE. Over a five-decade career, she's led the team solving some of the country's hardest cold cases, including the murders of Damilola Taylor and Stephen Lawrence. Angela, welcome to Lady Killers.
Thank you.
Angela, early on in your career, I know you worked on some of the crime scenes associated with the Yorkshire Ripper, Peter Sutcliffe. Was there a huge amount of pressure? I imagine there was because of the interest in that case.
Yes, there was an enormous press interest in that case. And I remember one particular scene where you were very well aware of the long lenses on these press cameras and the detail that they could see of the crime scene, and to the extent that the police had to put up screens to try and stop it.
More of that later. Now, to find out more about the Hampstead tragedy, I went with our resident historian, Professor Rosalind Crone, to suburban Belsize Park in North London.
This is Crossfield Road, and it was here that a young clerk was coming home on a Friday night after work in October 1890 when he discovered the body. Yes?
That's right. Lloyd's Weekly newspaper published a very useful picture of the scene where the body was found.
And there's the pavement, and there's the trees, just like today.
Just like today. And you see they've helpfully put a little cross in a circle.
X marks the spot.
Where the body was found. And this is quite typical in the late 19th century to provide illustrations of the crime scene or where the body was found and pointed out for members of the public so that they could come and visit. They could come here like murder tourists. Mm.
What did the police find when they turned up?
Well, the body, of course, but surprisingly, very little blood. One policeman with sharp eyes did find a small brass nut that was speckled with blood, and he popped it in his pocket thinking it might be of use
a
for
clue.
Later.
A clue.
A clue, that's right. And a short time later, about 2 miles from here in St John's Wood, they found a pram, an empty pram with a rug draped over it. They found the pram was wet, and it was wet with blood. So the policeman there wheeled the pram to the police station, and they found fairly quickly that the brass nut found here fitted on that pram.
So they found Tiggy's pram, but they don't know what's happened to Tiggy.
That's right. No sign yet of Tiggy.
What can you tell me about the dead woman?
Phoebe Hogg. Well, we know that she lived in a house in Kentish Town with multiple in-laws who weren't very nice to her. She had one child, her baby Tiggy. Her husband, Frank, was a bit of a controlling man. He didn't like her family coming to visit her or even writing to her. And he was often out of work. He couldn't hold down a job. The body was found on Friday, the 24th of October, in the evening. And newspaper editors were really keen to get copy ready for the newspapers going out on Saturday morning. Here's the Pall Mall Gazette. You see up here, a woman brutally murdered at Hampstead.
Ooh, discovery of a blood-covered perambulator.
Yeah, that's right. And this newspaper started to put forward some theories. So first of all, that the killer was a man.
Yes.
Second, that the victim was a prostitute. And third, that the identity of the killer might be Jack the Ripper.
You're joking.
Yeah.
Can anyone at all be killed in late 19th century London without it being attributed to Jack the Ripper?
Yeah. The police worked very hard, very quickly, to discredit that theory. But even the newspaper reports that say the police discredit this theory are still putting that idea in front of the public.
If this happened today, the street would be bustling with forensic scientists, wouldn't it, in their white suits? What was the state of forensic science in 1890?
Well, this is a time before blood groups. The most they can say about the blood found in the pram was that it was mammalian. It was from a mammal. And remember, the coverage of the Jack the Ripper case is so much about post-mortems and what a body could tell us about how it had been killed. And, of course, this is the age where Arthur Conan Doyle is publishing his famous detective novels.
Of course, Sherlock Holmes is just in print. And the first time we actually meet Sherlock Holmes, he's been bashing a corpse with a stick to see what kinds of wounds are produced. So it's definitely fair to say that forensic science is forming part of entertainment.
Yeah, it's a big part of popular culture, and this is a population obsessed with true crime and really hyped up.
Angela Gallup, Roz was talking there about the unhelpful assumptions made in this case by the press, that the victim was a prostitute, that the killer was a man, even possibly Jack the Ripper. Were there unhelpful assumptions like that made about the Yorkshire Ripper murders as well?
I think there were certainly probably some assumptions about prostitution. I think that was one of the things. Insofar as it was suspected to be a man, that just seemed very likely. But I mean, what the press says is one thing, and what you do as part of an inquiry is quite another.
Interesting. Well, let's go back to North London. Inspector Bannister, who's leading the investigation, questions Phoebe's husband, Frank. He also searches the lodgings Frank and Phoebe had lived in with Tiggy. Then, as now, the partner of a murder victim is an obvious suspect. But they don't find anything to link Frank to the murder, and they let him go. However, they do find in Frank's coat pocket a key for Mary Pearcy's house. She's the family friend who was identifying Phoebe's body at the mortuary. That's a bit odd, don't you think? Inspector Bannister thinks it's a bit odd too, and he decides to search Mary's lodgings as well. When Inspector Bannister arrives at Mary's ground floor rooms in nearby Priory Street, with Mary herself in tow, this is what he finds.
2 panes of the kitchen window were broken. The walls and ceiling and floor were bespattered with blood. A pair of lace curtains in a bath in the washhouse were stained with blood. Her hands were very much scratched and torn about. In the kitchen dustbin, I found a button, exactly the same as the ones on Mrs. Hogg's jacket, one of which was missing.
In the end, the police find 28 articles in Mary's lodgings with blood on them. These include some of her clothes, a poker, and a big knife. She says she's been killing mice. I think you need to kill an awful lot of mice to produce that much blood. Angela, there's an awful lot of blood in Mary Piercy's kitchen, which doesn't look good for her. What sort of things can blood tell us today with the benefit of the techniques that we have?
Well, actually, it's very interesting because reading the transcripts of Inspector Bannister's account, I was actually very surprised about the amount of detail that they were picking up, which is very much the sort of thing that we do these days. But of course, we do a lot more of it and it's a lot finer. But blood pattern analysis is a huge part of forensic science. So I was pretty impressed by the account of the blood staining. I don't think they made enough of it in terms of interpreting it, but they were pretty good with it.
What were the things that you can do that they absolutely couldn't? They didn't have blood type analysis, for example.
Well, I think that's the main thing. It's the other side of the coin. Blood pattern analysis is just as critical as it's ever been because it tells you what happened there. And, well, we now have DNA, but blood grouping before it could tell you from whom that blood could or couldn't have come.
Yes.
And so they kind of go together, and together they're tremendously powerful.
Do you feel a sense of kinship with your predecessors more than 100 years ago?
Yes, you can see what they did, and they were interested in damage to things, noting down the types of blood staining on the glass that had been broken and fallen outside, broken from the inside. That's something, you know, that we'd be interested in. So lots of different aspects of it that rang a bell with me. I thought, they've got that, you know, and so it's really good.
That's nice. Let's go back to the story. The police question Mary's neighbours about the events of the day before. The woman next door says that between 3 and 4, she heard glass smashing and a child screaming. Mary's upstairs neighbour says that at 6 o'clock, she saw a pram in the front hall and that Mary was anxious she didn't bump into it. And Elizabeth Rogers, who lives just down the street from Mary and actually knows her well, tells the police this.
A few minutes after 6, I was turning into Priory Place and I saw her wheeling a bassinet perambulator in the middle of the road. It was very heavily loaded and covered in some black stuff. When she saw me, she dropped her head over the handles. She had difficulty pushing it up the hill.
On Saturday afternoon, Mary Piercy is arrested. She proclaims her innocence.
I would not do such a dreadful thing. I would not hurt anyone.
The newspapers are astonished that a woman has been arrested for this awful crime. Meanwhile, in Mary's cell at Kentish Town Police Station, her clothes are examined by a female searcher called Sarah Sawtell. Mary initiates a conversation.
On Thursday, I wrote a note to Mrs. Hogg to invite her to tea on Friday afternoon.
Did she come?
Yes. Between 4 and 4:15. As we were having tea, Mrs. Hogg made some remark I did not like. One word brought up another. Perhaps I had better say no more.
This is as close as Mary Piercy ever comes to admitting involvement in this crime. Angela Gallup, I guess another thing that's changed enormously since 1890. If you were investigating this crime today, I guess digital technology would play a huge part. Phones, CCTV, that sort of thing. They didn't have that.
Yes, absolutely. It's very likely that Mary would have texted Phoebe to invite her to tea rather than writing a little note. I think it would all be done on a mobile phone or something like that. So you would have that. You could have a cell site saying where the phones were at particular times of day, which could be really interesting. And CCTV, there's so much of that about now, so many cameras, both sort of generally, but also domestically, that you might be able to get images of the woman pushing the pram and so on.
Next comes a terribly sad discovery. Early on Sunday morning, a peddler finds the body of a very small child lying in nettles on a building site less than a mile from where Phoebe was found. It's Tiggy. a post-mortem fails to identify the cause of her death. Angela, I'm interested in the obsession that I have, we have, with forensic science on television. What do they get right? Are there common things that they get wrong?
Well, I think there are certain sorts of programmes that I can't watch, you know, and because, I mean, there's one, without naming any names, where the sort of heroine is amazing. She does about 7 different jobs at once and all brilliantly and all interlinked and everything. And that's completely not possible. And so I find it very difficult to watch that. And yet it's incredibly popular. And I wouldn't deny anybody entertainment, you know, whatever the subject, including forensic science. But it is a complete nonsense anyway, in the real life.
Well, you couldn't have been clearer about that. It's official. It's nonsense. Yeah. Television, I can't help but notice, really loves a female forensic scientist. Shows like Silent Witness. Are most forensic scientists female or not? How does the balance go?
Well, these days they probably are. There was a time, though, I mean, years ago, when beginning of my career in the early 70s, when there were relatively few and very few women who did the whole job, went to crime scenes, directed the lab work, did the lab work, and then went to court. But nowadays, that's changed considerably. I actually think that a balance between the two sexes is a good thing, because then you get things looked at in a slightly different way. And that's very helpful when you're trying to work out what might have happened or what somebody would have done or wouldn't have done. So it's useful.
Back to the story. The police have made another discovery about Frank Hogg. The reason he has a key to Mary Pierce's lodgings is that he was having an affair with her. They found love letters between the two of them. It seems he visited her so often that her neighbours thought that he was actually her husband. At the inquest into Phoebe and Tiggy's deaths, Frank decides it's best to come clean.
I'm going to speak the truth, sir. I confess I was intimate with Mrs. Piercy. I don't think my wife knew anything about it.
Frank Hogg is not coming out of this at all well. But what's really striking about this case is the way it's playing out in the public arena. People now pay money to the undertakers to see the bodies of Phoebe and Tiggy, and hundreds try to storm their funeral. Frank's mother gives cozy interviews to the press. It seems that everybody wants to be a part of this. Angela, I'm hearing echoes here of the recent case of Nicola Bully, who went missing while she was walking her dog near her home in Lancashire. The police had to beg people to stay away from the area, didn't they, while they were investigating? And I know that the speculation on social media about what had happened to her was very upsetting for her family. What's your thoughts about this desire people have to get involved?
I mean, I think there that you might get people who actually want to help, want to see if they can find out what happened to her or find her body or, you know, do something. So I think you can understand a certain amount of it. But as for sort of tourism, for want of a better word, that sometimes goes along with it, well, that's pretty awful.
On the 1st of December 1890, at the Old Bailey, Mary Pearcy's trial begins. It lasts for 3 days. Frank Hogg has an alibi for the day of the murder. A colleague testifies that he and Frank were working together all day until 7:15 p.m. That's after Phoebe's body was found. Some of Mary's many love letters to Frank are read out in court.
My dear Frank, my heart will break if you go away. How do you think I can live? My heart throbs with pain only thinking about it. What would I do if you went? I should die. Do you know how lonely I am?
These letters are really desperate. Mary's totally enthralled to Frank and anxious that he might be going to end their affair. And they show that she has a really strong motive for murder. Jealousy of Phoebe. If Mary can get Phoebe and Tiggy out of the way, she can perhaps have Frank all to herself. The only light relief comes from Inspector Bannister.
I tested the perambulator to see whether it would bear the weight of a body. I got into it myself, was covered up, and wheeled about in it.
Angela, have you ever been wheeled about in a perambulator?
I have never been, no, I have. I've been dragged about, all sorts of things. I've had my clothes ripped off me, all kinds of other things. And these little experiments, and it's another example of where, you know, Bannister is a bit ahead of his time. He's absolutely doing the right things. He's trying stuff out.
Now, I'm curious to know if modern forensic science might be able to work out more about the role of Frank Hogg in all of this. For instance, do you think that Mary could have got this corpse into the pram by herself? What do you think about that?
Well, it does seem to be quite extraordinary. I mean, we have the height and the weight of Phoebe's body and, you know, it would have been a huge effort. And I was sort of slightly surprised by that.
Well, I think the police were surprised too and speculated that maybe he'd given her a hand.
Mm.
If this were happening today, Frank's DNA would be all over his home with Phoebe and also Mary's lodgings too, because he'd visited her. What would you be looking for that might link him not just to the place, but specifically to the crime?
Well, you might be looking for fingerprints in blood. And actually, that's something that I wondered, because fingerprints were definitely coming in at the end of the century.
Back to the Old Bailey. The evidence against Mary Pearcey is compelling. All that blood in her kitchen, the neighbour who sees her wheeling the loaded pram away from her house. In his summing up, the judge doesn't hold back his feelings about Frank Hogg.
No man could have given himself a viler and more loathsome character.
But it's not Frank who's on trial, it's Mary. The jury takes less than 30 minutes to consider their verdict, and it's guilty.
Have you anything to say why the court should not proceed to pronounce sentence of death upon you?
Only that I am innocent of this crime.
I met up with Roz Crone in central London to hear the end of Mary's story. Roz, what happened to Mary next?
Well, her lawyer makes an appeal for clemency on the grounds that she has epilepsy. Apparently, she was dropped on her head as a toddler and then suffered fits and seizures afterwards. Also, we know she suffered from depression and she also attempted suicide following the death of her father.
Was any of this mentioned actually during her trial?
No, and you might wonder why a plea of insanity wasn't put to the court. But basically, Mary insisted that she wasn't insane. She refused to do that.
And was the plea for clemency successful?
No, it wasn't. She had visits from her mother, and she really wanted a visit from Frank, but he refused. And so, on the 23rd of December, she was hanged inside the walls of Newgate Prison.
I think it's time to reveal to our listeners what it is that we're doing here just across the road from Madame Tussauds. And the reason is that over there on display in the Chamber of Horrors, they have a really gruesome twist in the tail of this case. They have on display Tiggy's actual pram, the perambulator. Well, what's it doing there?
Well, Madame Tussauds often did this, as well as creating these wax statues of famous murderers. They would often try to buy things from the scene of the crime. So Mary's mother sold a lot of her furniture in order to pay for the legal case. And she managed to raise £200 from the sale. And what Madame Tussauds did is they used all of these items to create a tableau of Mary in her kitchen, in the scene of the crime. There was a massive public obsession with this case. When this tableau opened, around 31,000 spectators turned up to see it on the very first day. They also took casts of Phoebe and Tiggy from nature. That's, you know, after they had died. The police returned the pram to Frank after they had finished with it. And he sold that onto Madame Tussauds as well for £25. Frank the Rotter, and you never believe what he also did. Frank also sold his own beard to go on the wax statue they created of him.
This man just beggars belief.
He certainly does.
Roz has joined us in the studio. Hi, Roz.
Hello, Lucy. And hello, Angela.
Roz, do we know what happened to the awful Frank Hogg?
After the trial, he quickly left London. He wasn't hanging around, and we haven't been able to trace him.
Angela, what do you take away from this case of Mary Pearcey?
I was fairly impressed by the police investigation, actually. And, you know, the things that they were doing, the little experiments, the little reconstructions they were doing, when they had, as we would know them today, almost no scientific tools at all. But just the beginnings of understanding about blood patterns, and they were trying hard to understand the scene and get it right. I must admit, when I started reading the papers, I thought, I wonder if I'm going to think this could have been a miscarriage by the end. But actually, as things went on, and there's so much evidence there against Mary Pearcey, I think it was probably quite safe, the conviction that they made.
Wells, what do you take away from the case?
Well, this was such a horrendous and brutal murder. I think that even today it's hard for us to believe it was committed entirely by a woman. And that's where we get really tempted to keep pulling in the husband, the lover, Frank Hogg. We think he must have done it, or he must have been involved somehow. But we cannot know from the distance of time. What's interesting is the brutality of this crime, though, and also the gender of the killer, that it was a woman, has given this case a much more enduring role in kind of the true crime genre than a lot of other cases in the 19th century. And I think when we focus on these types of cases too much, it overshadows more ordinary forms of female killing and ultimately, in the end, really limits our understanding of women in the past and what they are capable of.
Interesting. I think that's such a good insight from Roz. This is a rare crime, and it's attracted more attention than it deserves. At the heart of this story are two women with very short, very sad lives. Phoebe's betrayed by her husband before her murder, and while it's hard to have any pity for Mary, her life is dominated by epilepsy and poverty. But this case comes in the wake of the Jack the Ripper killings, when true crime reaches fever pitch. Everyone, the press, the public, wants to play detective and be part of the story. 1890 is a long time ago. But that sounds awfully familiar, doesn't it? Well, a huge thank you to Dr. Angela Gallup and Professor Rosalind Crone. Next time, we meet Kitty Newton, a daughter accused of killing her own mother. Is it murder, or is there more to the case than meets the eye? Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Jane Greenwood, and the readers are Claire Corbett, William Hope, Jonathan Keeble, and Ruth Sillers. The executive producer is Kirsty Hunter, and the commissioning editor for BBC Radio 4 is Rhiann Roberts. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4. And you can listen first to the episodes if you search for Lady Killers on BBC Sounds. See you next time.
How does someone invent a political theory that reshapes the map of the world? How do you get to a scientific breakthrough that saves thousands of lives or create works of art that stand the test of time? How have brilliant thinkers through history done their best thinking, and what can we learn from them? From BBC Radio 4, it's the second series of Human Intelligence with me, Naomi Alderman. From Karl Marx to Marie Curie, from Emily Bronte to Leonardo da Vinci. How did those exceptional minds do their work? And are there ways of thinking we can emulate today? To find out, listen to Human Intelligence on BBC Sounds.